you believe that? Ah!
All right. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's chair speaker from Visalia. Please welcome John W.
Oh, hi. My name is John W., and I am an alcoholic. This is my first shot at a Zoom meeting of any variety whatsoever. I'm here on invitation. Appreciate the fact that Bill thought of me and invited me to come share my experience, strength, and hope with whomever may show to this meeting eventually. It's rather a new experience for me to share in this fashion and feel like I'm at an AA meeting. It's kind of an eerie feeling, and almost like I'm sitting here talking to myself, but I can see that Bill's there watching, and I can see him. I stopped drinking alcoholic beverages on August 6th, 1991. Up until that time, I drank in a fashion that made me realize that I had a problem. Since I got sober and stopped drinking alcohol, I subsequently did have a window in my life in which I was not drinking, but I was definitely not sober either. And so the drug of choice, I shall not, I'm not going to mention it here now because out of respect for the meeting and that you guys stick into alcohol and alcoholism. So, my earliest memories of booze or alcohol in my life go back, first off, as far as I know, any living members that I was in contact with, my family on both my dad's side and my side, that were of blood relatives, had no drinking issues. I saw my father drunk once in my life. He was the guy who would open a can of beer and drink half of it, and that would be it. He'd open a bottle of wine, and it'd be in the refrigerator for 6 months before he even decided, well, that's no good anymore, so they just throw it out after he drank half a glass out of it. Any alcohol that I did consume in my early years was very small amount. I remember once my parents thought it was amusing, and it never went anywhere. I opened a beer, drank from it. I don't remember getting any kind of buzz from it. I remember I'd take a sip, put it back in the refrigerator, come back, and take another sip. And they thought that was interesting, and I never even remember feeling any effect whatsoever from it. So apparently I didn't drink much of it. And not enough to recognize any change in the way I felt, that's for sure. Also, the only other time that I had experience with alcoholic beverages as a child, preteen, that is, was around Christmas time. We would squeeze pomegranates that my grandparents grew out on my ranch, and we'd have a bunch of pomegranates. Juice, and then my mom would get this sweet Jewish wine. I think it was called Mogan David, and she would add some of that to it. And once again, we'd drink it, and I imagine the amount of alcohol in there was so minute that none of us ever felt any of the effects from it. So that was my extent of being exposed to any kind of alcohol as a child. I did have an uncle who was in the Navy, and he was indeed shit-faced, falling down every day, drunk. And that was my only, but he wasn't a blood relative. So as far as, you know, any childhood influences from the disease, actual practitioners of alcoholism, I never really had any of that going on. And into my adulthood, none of my siblings developed any kind of drinking problems or drug problems of any kind. I was the one who did. And I can recall some earlier times when I got drunk. One of them was when it was a hot summer day and I was playing tennis with my friend and I don't even remember where we got it, but I remember I think I drank 4 beers really fast, and then I ended up throwing up all over the place, and my friends got all pissed at me because they had to clean up the puke. And another time, I got drunk at New Year's Eve, and that amateur night, everybody does that. I think I was like 14, and I remember the next day smelling some beer or wine or whatever. I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to touch this shit again. But, as time went on and I went through puberty, my emotional stature in life started to change. And as far as I can recollect, I think that right around 13 or 14 when I started going through puberty, I was starting to develop depression. And so I was not able to share how I really felt with a single person on this planet. I knew something was wrong with me, and I couldn't figure it out. But at the same time, being that this was the early 70s, early to mid 70s, and, getting help for emotional and psychological issues was really was stigmatized in those days. And so I was afraid. I was afraid to actually ask for help, and I had no idea what I would do to ask for help. Even I wasn't raised in a family where we were educated in such a way that we could communicate with each other in a way that really expressed how we really felt, So I was naturally attracted to weed because it was readily available, and that was pretty much my drug of choice through high school because I was not very experienced at getting people to buy booze for me, and there was not much in the house for me to get anyhow. But as time went by and I finally turned 21 and I had a job, I found myself doing this, day after I got off work, I'd buy myself a tall beer and drink that in the car on the way home, and that was about the extent of it. But then I remember another time that I actually turned to alcohol as a source of medicine, I guess you might say, for my emotional issues. And what had happened was one day my mom had a cerebral aneurysm, and it was a real scary touch-and-go kind of thing for her. We weren't sure she was going to die or live or be in a coma or, anything like that. And so I was in quite a bit of anxiety at that time. I was really worried, and I wanted to escape from that feeling. I did not like that feeling, and I did not know how to deal with it in the least. And nobody was there to help me with it, so I remember for years my parents had this pint of Old Crow unopened that was under the sink. And I remember it must have been there for 10, 15 years, because it was in the first house we lived. We moved several times in town, and I remember that same old bottle of Old Crow was right there under the sink. The seal was never even broken on it. But after my mom got that episode with the aneurysm, my anxiety was so high and I wanted to treat it. I knew where there was some booze and I used it and I got drunk on it. And, you know, that kind of thing actually works to treat emotional issues. And when you find something that will actually medicate your feelings and do a pretty good job at it, you find yourself going back to that medicine all the time. Well, unfortunately, as everybody knows here, that shit has side effects. And I don't like the side effects of booze, but I like the main effect of it, relieving anxiety and fear and that sort of thing. So when I finally turned 21, I found myself more and more often turning to booze to relieve my emotional distress. And, you know, I would buy, I was not a picky drinker. I did not care anything about the flavor of the booze I was drinking. All I knew was that there was alcohol in this beverage, whether it was wine or whiskey or beer, and it got me where I wanted to go. So that would give me the buzz that I wanted. I'd go to the store and I'd buy just a big 2-gallon jug of wine, the one that has the little metal screw on, because I didn't give a crap about the taste. And I can take a cup like this, fill it up, and just drink it all in one shot. And I would do that. I found myself doing that more and more often. And didn't have any negative consequences much at all. I wasn't getting hungover, and I wasn't getting any. I never got a single DUI. I never got pulled over once while I was drinking. Never had an accident of any sort. Never even blacked out. But I finished college. I graduated. We got a job that finally paid a decent salary. And I had enough money I could buy as much booze as I wanted. And when I finally moved out of the house, and I didn't have to, you know, go sneak out a drink out in my bedroom, you know, I just found that every day that I was at home, I was drunk, started being drunk every single day, whether I wanted to or not. And it got to the point where, you know, if I got off work and I knew there was 2 beers in the refrigerator, I know that that wouldn't be even close to enough. So I would always make sure that when I got home, I had enough booze, whether it was beer or wine or whiskey, whatever I chose to drink for the day, it was going to get me where I wanted to go. And, you know, by that time I was living by myself. I was young. I had the money to buy the booze I wanted, but, you know, that word by myself is the key to my disease right there. I was in an apartment. I was by myself. I had no relationship with any significant other of any kind. I had friendships. Don't get me wrong. I've always had friendships, and I'm grateful for that. I mean, that's a saving grace for me, but, you know, I was often lonely and bored. And when you're lonely and bored, your best friend comes out of a bottle. And, you know, I went on like that with hardly any negative consequences until, you know, a couple of years into my career as a school teacher. It was a summer vacation. Not much different than this summer with all the heat. Just one day after another, and I was in my apartment. Found myself drunk almost every single day of my summer vacation. And that's not what I wanted to do with myself. And I found myself doing that when I didn't want to. And so, you know, I get up in the morning, I think, okay, I'm going to use this day constructively. I'll get some work done. I'll go out, ride my bike. I'll call my friends, do whatever, have some fun, go play some racquetball, go swimming. But instead, I'd get up and I'd just start drinking, no matter what time of the day it was. I thought I was unusual in that. I used to drink beer at 6 in the morning, get up in the morning, and that was my breakfast, beer. And so I basically passed out. And I'd been doing that every single day, and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I was throwing up, and I was hungover every day, and I started having the shakes, and you know that. I do remember that I had seen some shows in the past where they talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, so I knew it was out there. And I remember hearing some, like, Donahue shows or whatever about how alcoholism was on the rise again, especially with young people and so forth, but never really meant anything to me. Until one day, you know, I just had a moment of clarity where I was like, you know what? This is how my life's going, and it pretty much looks like this is it. This is the way it's going to go from now until the end of my life. I'm just going to get drunk every day that I can. Never showed up for work drunk, but I sure smelled like booze a long time. And I just thought, well, I'm just getting drunk every day. I'm going to do this, and I know what is going to happen to me. I'm just going to ruin my health. And I know I won't die right away. It might take 10, 20 years, but, you know, I was like, you know what? What if I go 20, 30 years like this? My body could maybe hold out for 30 years of hard drinking like this. And then I'd look back at my life, and I find that this is it. I've only got this one thing to say about my life. I spent every fucking day of my life drunk off my ass. And they're going to find me dead one day, all alone. Died from cirrhosis of the liver, or fell down drunk, and, you know, can't remember the name of that actor who fell down and busted his head on the coffee table and bled out at home. But anyhow, I thought, well, that's going to be my legacy. And so I figured, I got to the point one day, I said, I do not want this to be my life anymore. I don't know what the fuck to do about it. I know that I need booze every day. And I know that I'm addicted to it. I cannot not drink. But what the hell, I'll give it a shot. What else do I have to do? I mean, can try it, see what happens. And so I looked in the yellow pages under AA, and I found the phone number of a recovery center here in town, owned by, I don't know if you know him, Bill, or not, but his name is Clyde Clotch. His name's up in the lawn club. And he had he called it AWARE. And he had a group for alcoholics and drug addicts. Intense inpatient program, and then, you know, outpatient too. And another guy named Frank, I think Frank Ross was his name, old timer. Him and Charlene, they ran the intensive care part of the program. But I made a phone call, and I just got an answering service, and I thought, well, fuck, I don't know what's going to happen. But I don't know, it could have been an hour, could have been 20 minutes, could have been 10 minutes later, I don't know. I got a phone call later that night from Clyde, and I was completely surprised at how I reacted to it, because I had no idea what to expect from the program or that, you know, how it worked. My vision of Alcoholics Anonymous was sad people got together and basically they told hacks on how they stay away from drinking, you know? And I thought, you know what, you guys can try that with me. I'm sure I could stay dry for a week or two, but I know me. I'm not going to stay dry. Something will happen. And I'll be right back at it because I need some relief from, you know, all the slings and arrows that life has to shoot at me. And then I gave it a shot. And to my amazement, the very first meeting I ever went to, I actually was like, hey, this is cool. People are laughing. Unfortunately, they all smoked at that time, but they were laughing and having a good time, but I didn't quite understand everything they were talking about. But the thing that got me and the thing that was a huge surprise to me was the fellowship of AA that was there, and that people were happy. People were joking. A lot of people weren't even talking about drinking anymore. They were just talking about life. And I was like, yeah, I can do this. And so I started going to meetings. And I was so fortunate that I lost the craving almost right away. I can't tell you that I lost that day, that first meeting, but I can tell you that I never had that urge that said, oh, you need a drink so bad, dude. We got to fight this. You can't take a drink. Just make it through the day without taking a drink. I never had that, any of that go on. It was just like, okay, I'm done drinking. And I'm committed to staying sober now. And I'm very fortunate that I never had any of that craving come back. I've seen lots of people who fight the cravings. And people who have that, my prayers to them, because that's a bitch to deal with. I do know from experience, from other chemicals that I've used in my life, that even if you do have the cravings, the old saying of this too shall pass is very true. It goes away. And especially if you take that craving with you to a meeting and you tell on yourself, or you get on the phone and you talk to another alcoholic about the craving that you're thinking about doing. For some reason, anytime I tell on myself, whether it has to do with a craving or a drug or a drink or some behavior that can get me into a fix that I know I earned on my own due to choices, but can't turn off the feeling machine that says you want to do certain things that can get you in trouble. I've found that if you take those feelings and you honestly share them with another person, and your goal in life is to live a decent, clean, you know, what they call a spiritual life, a moral life, then 99% of the time, well, so far, 100% of the time, I haven't had to give in to those cravings. And I'm very grateful for that. And since that time, that was back in 1991, I had some really high quality recovery for quite a while there. But I did have an issue with outside chemicals after surgery, and I woke my monster, and my monster came out of the cage and did not do as much damage as a lot of other people's monsters have done in their life. And like I said, I've gotten where I am today without ever being arrested once in my life or even questioned by the police during a time when I was under the influence of any kind of chemical. And I've just had lots of opportunities to grow in this program to the point where today I live my life knowing that I'm going to have feelings that I don't like. In fact, today was sort of a day like that. I don't know where that came from, but, well, I kind of do. I don't think I was 100% physically well today And so my day kind of started off waking up not feeling the way I like to feel. You know, I had a little bit of a headache, and I was not very energetic, and thought, well, maybe I'm coming down with something. And I just felt in low gear all day today. But the thing is, I know that that's a normal part of life. That's how life works for me today. And I was very grateful when I got that message from Bill this afternoon that asked me if I'd share on the Zoom meeting. And I was grateful because it helps me to feel like I'm a part of, I'm not apart from, and that I have something that maybe some other people might appreciate, might have something going on in my life that I could share with other people that other people might relate to and want to actually hear what I have to say. And there's a real spiritual message behind that for me, because I know that for myself, I, you know, going back to the beginning of my message, I drank to deal with loneliness and boredom. And those are two things that are big triggers for me that I didn't know how to deal with when I was younger. And today, I believe I have some tools that I can actually deal with those feelings in such a way that's much healthier, much more productive, and that gets me through, gives me faith. And actually, with each time I get through a day, an episode, where you know, you feel, whether you feel depressed or lonely or anxious, fearful, when you get through the other side of those things, that's one more piece of evidence that you can do it and that it can be done, so that the next time you get to a situation like that, you've got banked up the faith that you need so that you can get through life and do life the way that works for me much better than doing it with drugs and alcohol in my body. I just can't put up with the side effects of that shit anymore, and I don't want to. And so with that, that's about all I got to share for now. You seem to have disappeared. I don't know where you went, Bill, but if you're there.
I'm here. Ben. I'm here, John. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being part of our fellowship and being willing to jump in and share your experience, strength, and hope with us tonight. So thank you for doing that. Hey, so we have we're now starting the discussion portion of our meeting, and we'd like to hear from as many different people as possible. So we'll turn the meeting back over to John to pick on people to share.
Let's see, it kind of reminds me of Henry Ford when he said, you can buy any color of car you want, provided it's black. So I can pick anybody I want to speak as long as his name is Bill.
Well, surprisingly, we do have someone that joined us. Roxanne is here. I don't know if she's interested in sharing, but that's an option.
I can't see her on my side, though. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
If you swipe your screen to the left, you should be able to see more people.
There we go. Okay, now I see her. What is Roxanna?
Hi.
Nice to meet you, Roxanna. You know, the thing that I was thinking about it for sharing, and something that I've been hearing lately, I listen to podcasts, and one of the podcasts that I've discovered is called The Science of Happiness, and they talk about different subjects, you know, like going, appreciating nature, learning how to forgive yourself, things like that, all as part of the process, I guess, of being able to deal with life. So one of the things that I heard today that stuck out with me, and that if anybody cares to share about, if you have any input, is a concept called self-compassion. So having compassion for yourself, for the person you used to be, you know, so that you can forgive yourself for having this disease and the shit that you put yourself through and other people through. And at the same time, for the person you are now, if you're going through, you know, whatever kind of issues, I don't know what kind of issues you guys are going through out there, but the idea of having compassion on your own self, how do you treat yourself when you're, you know, I don't know what kind of internal dialogue you guys have, or are you self-deprecating? Do you struggle with your self-esteem? Do you, you know, are those issues that directly impact your, you know, the disease of alcoholism? I don't know, but if you want to talk to that, that's a subject that came to mind. Other than that, I don't have any other ideas, so I'll throw that out for you guys.
Okay, so I'm new to this, and I'm barely starting recovery. I've been going through a lot this past year and lost my children. And so now I'm trying to do what I have to do to get them back. And it's hard. I'm not going to say it's not. It's hard, you know. Got on. And it's just, it's been a battle. Like, I just keep, I don't want to say, like, in denial. You know, I was in a lot of denial, thinking, you know what, I can have a problem. But then when I really think about it, it's like, you know, Roxana, you do have a problem and you need to seek help for it. And so, you know, I'm just trying my best right now. I'm just trying to get through it. Just get through day by day, you know, working and doing my classes and whatever else I have to do. And so, that's kind of about it.
So thank you, Roxana. We're glad that you're here. And, John, I'll save you the task of calling on me next, because I'm the only one left here. So I'll just jump in. I appreciate you, again, jumping in and being a service tonight. I heard a number of things in your story that I could relate to. You mentioned struggling with relapse, and that was that was something I would say I identified with early on. I think I have a little different opinion about that now, but I don't know how much I want to get into that particular aspect of this. You talked about avoiding trouble, legal trouble, not getting arrested, and you know, I don't know why for the life of me I seem to I don't know, be like wearing a Teflon suit or something. Friends around me were constantly getting into trouble, and I was doing all the same things they were doing, and for whatever stupid reason, I just always managed to slip through. I mean, and I had interactions with the police under the influence, clearly could have been arrested. And why they choose to let me go, I just really can't explain. I stopped and counted it one time, and I think there were like 11 different instances where I had an encounter with law enforcement. I was under the influence. I was in possession. I was operating under the influence. I was all of those things, right? And you know, I also oftentimes forget that I did actually finally get into some trouble. I just keep forgetting that part of the story. But the truth of the matter is that I did spend a couple nights in jail, and I got arrested and charged with operating a watercraft under the influence, because the boat that I was driving, I misjudged the distance, and I ended up hitting a friend of mine with the boat. And it was a tragic, terrible accident. I managed to put the propeller through my friend, and thankfully he survived. And you know, again, I still just think that that's given the potential, that's a significant amount of luck, how someone could do what I've done and still not get in. I mean, you know, I spent a couple nights in jail. They gave me a fine and they sent me home. That was it. I didn't lose my job. I didn't, you know, none of those obvious outward signs. Most people I worked with, people, you know, my neighbors, people around me, my family, for the most part, didn't have any knowledge about that happening in my life at all. That's how ridiculously, you know, minor the consequences were for me. But, you know, something that I've been taught to do through the process of going through our 12 steps is to actually take an honest inventory of my life, my relationships, my experiences. And through the process of doing that, there is one area of my life that was tragically littered with failure. And it has to do with relationships. If you want to look at friends, most of the people who, you know, were friendly with me just couldn't stand to be around me for very long because it just wasn't as much fun for them as it was for me. I always got the better half of the stick. You know, my idea of fun was at their expense in many cases. And if you look at, you know, romantic relationships or significant relationships, I was engaged, 3 times, been married twice now. I left wreckage in my wake. I would present this persona to a woman who captured my attention, and I would be all the things that I thought she, you know, might want in a relationship. Just as soon as she seemed to be involved, engaged in the relationship, then this voice in the back of my head, if you will, would tell me that you know once she finds out who you are, she's going to leave. You know, once the truth about who you are comes out, she's going to be out of here, like she should be. She shouldn't be here in the first place if she knew who you were. And so my drinking would spike. And while I was drinking, I would act foolishly and act like an ass. And as a result, I had many, many relationships fail at my own hand. And if you've been there with me, excuse me. If you had been there with me at the time, I would have certainly tried to convince you that I was a victim of, you know, vindictive women that, you know, just didn't have a sense of humor and were really just out to get my money or whatever, you know, and it's just ridiculous. I imagine also that. That some of my behavior has probably shaved a few years off of my possible lifespan. That's a hard thing to measure, right? And they talk about that in our book that, you know, if we're told that, you know, if we keep on drinking, it might reduce, you know, how long we'll live. I'm getting older and that shaved off time is starting to concern me, you know? But when I'm out there running and gunning, you know, it doesn't feel like it. So I'm certain too that, I'm certain that my drinking and my behavior, also caused me to miss out on maybe like promotions or pay raises or opportunities to be in relationships, because it was so apparent to people, you know, that I was a bad bet. And, you know, today things are a lot different. One of the things that, that was presented to me as I was working through this, you know, self-inventory process was, you know, I mean, this is a very normal thing for us. Where, in fact, I would even argue that we are not intended to live life alone, that we're intended to be in relationship. And so, you know, I had ran everybody off out of my life, and so I was beginning to think that maybe it was time to consider getting back into the dating pool, and I was really concerned about that because I'd had such bad failure in that area. And so I shared with my sponsor these thoughts, these ideas, and he suggested something that I thought was maybe a little, I don't know, I thought he was maybe taking this thing a little too seriously. You know, it's like, come on, man, give me a break. But he suggested this idea. He said, you know, if you'll continue to go down the path of these 12 steps, you're at that time I was in the middle of my inventory, and I was getting ready to start looking for shortcomings and character defects and then start making amends to people. And he said, you know, if you continue down this path, you're going to have the opportunity to make decisions that will create for you a lifestyle that might be appealing to the kind of people that you want in your life. And in fact, part of that fourth step inventory is a sex inventory. And by sex inventory, I mean, you know, there's this little seventh grader in me every time I say those words that wants to giggle, you know, a sex inventory. It's not what it sounds like. What it was for me was an inventory of my past relationships, which there was a great deal of failure, but then also very important. It included an exercise where I was to identify the ideal romantic or sexual relationship. And through that process, I got to, you know, sit down and really think about what the perfect partner for me would look like. And you know, that list included a lot of really highfalutin ideas, if you will. You know, I felt like, you know, I need to be able to trust her with everything. I mean, like, you know, my deepest secrets, my money. I need to be able to trust her with people. I need to just trust her with everything. And I wanted someone who would share my spiritual beliefs, right? And that became important because I had dated outside of my particular religious practice, and it didn't occur to me until much later what kind of problems that would create in the family. So I wanted someone with similar spiritual ideas as mine, and I wanted to have some shared interests, you know. Travel, sporting events, whatever. I wanted her and I to both enjoy the same kinds of things. And so, my sponsor asked me, you know, how trustworthy, I was at that point. And I had to be honest, and, you know, I hadn't had a very long track record of being a terribly trustworthy person. And he also asked me, you know, how was I doing at actually upholding my own spiritual beliefs? So I had you know, moral and spiritual values that I claimed to be my own. But his question was, you know, how accurately am I living to those ideals? And so the funny thing was is that as I began to make some progress in getting closer to living according to those principles, this amazing woman popped into my life, you know, right out of the internet. And she and I have now been married for, it's almost 12 and a half years. I honestly did not think that it was possible for me to have a relationship like the one that I have with my wife. And I'd like to, you know, lead you all to believe that it's perfect and we never have any disagreements. And that's just not practical. But there are very few things that we disagree on. And she might have a different point of view, but I will say that I certainly feel as though we've never had a fight, you know. And I mean, you know, I don't mean like a disagreement. I mean like we've never had a fight like I used to have, you know. Like, hey, it's my way or you get out of here, you know. That's just never ever happened for us. And I'm convinced that that the things that have changed in my life, the quality of the problems that I have in my life today, are directly a result of my being willing and to take actions that that the AA program suggests. You know, getting the sponsor, going to meetings, being a part of this fellowship, being vulnerable. You know, and Roxana and John, both of you were vulnerable today, talking about things that are, you know, dear to your heart and things that, you know, we're not particularly proud of. But you know, by sharing our struggles and our challenges, we get an opportunity to develop relationships with people that we also get to share our successes with. And that's certainly been a big part of my life. So I want to thank you guys for joining me here tonight. I don't see anyone else who can share, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up a few minutes early. The Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our